welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School, Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls. It's been commissioned by the Development Office, where basically I talk to old Edwardians who've gone off to have fantastic careers after crossing Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. My name is Ben Anderson. I'm a podcast producer. My company's called Sound Rebel, but I spent a decade in the radio industry. Today, I'm joined by someone who I know very well. I should know what year you left King Edward's High School for Girls, because you're in the same year and best friends with my brother Tom, but I can't remember. Grace Gwynn, how are you?
Hi Ben, thanks for having me. I left
2013.
That's so. The year after your brother. I met your brother through drama and the train. So it didn't matter what year anyone was in. If you got the Hogwarts Express, the 7:36 from Four Oaks train station, you were going to be friends.
You know what? You'd always have that, wouldn't you? Like, how'd you know him? Oh, train.
The highlight of the school day.
Grace, you are a barrister. You're currently third six pupil at number 5 Barristers Chambers in Birmingham. Would you mind explaining what third six pupil means?
Yes. So in order to become a barrister, a proper established barrister, you go through all the academic training, you know, the law degree or the law conversion, and then the year of intense training called the BPTC, where you learn the specialist skills required to be a barrister. You then go through the grueling process of getting pupillage. And what pupillage in effect is 12 months of your life. The first 6 months you shadow other barristers and learn the job firsthand. You accompany them to court. You sit in chambers with them doing their paperwork. And then the second 6 months, you're out on your own. You're doing your own casework, meeting your own clients and solicitors. But they've got that kind of supervisory role. So you've got a mentor, you can talk to them, and your work is somewhat monitored. So I did my pupillage, my 12 months at a chambers in Devon. And then at the end of those 12 months, they make a decision as to whether they keep you or whether they say thanks, but no thanks. And that decision is called tenancy. So I was offered tenancy from my chambers in Devon, but I wanted to come home. Number 5 chambers is a brilliant set that I've always wanted to belong to. And so I applied there for a third 6. And effectively that's 6 more months onto my training where I do my own casework, but I also shadow other barristers when I'm not doing my own cases. And I'm coming to the end of that now. And then next month, they'll make a decision as to whether they keep me. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed for that.
So next month is your tenancy decision.
March, for number 5. Yeah.
Well, I mean, would you like to take this opportunity to say how fantastic they are? How great the working atmosphere is?
No, they are a brilliant set. Funnily enough, it was a set that I did work experience with when I was at school. And I was so overwhelmed by how brilliant they were that I didn't apply to them for the first couple of years of my applications because I just didn't think I'd ever be good enough to get there and I didn't want to waste my time. And then I did a further lot of work experience with them when I was postgraduate and I thought, I could do all right here. And then I tried and here we are.
Well, we're going to talk about your route to your career shortly because we were talking a little bit before we started recording about how it hasn't always been an easy route. There's been a few hurdles that you've had to go over. Were you the youngest barrister in the country at one point, Grace? Is that a title that you can claim?
Well, so I'm told. So in order to be a barrister, you have to belong to an inn of court. And there are 4 inns of court and I belong to Lincoln's Inn. Now, when I passed my bar exams, I think I was 20 turning 21. And I got a call from the inn to say that I passed my exams and that I was the youngest person on their roster. So there was a good chance that I was the youngest barrister from that year's cohort. Mm. But whether or not that claim's true, I have no idea. But I quite enjoy it. I do like it.
In terms of when you left school then, because you're back in Birmingham now, but you've been globetrotting a little bit. What happened? So you went across Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. Did you know then that this is what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I knew when I was 16. I'd always been quite argumentative, I think, as a child. I'd always enjoyed a debate and going back and forth with friends. And I remember watching a crime show and it was a courtroom drama and watching the way they spoke in court and the fact they were arguing for a living. I thought, this is incredible. And also I'd done performing arts my entire life. So for me, it was the perfect combination of your acting effectively, but you're also arguing some quite legal technical points. And I just thought, this is the career for me. So I told my career advisor person at school, I'm going to law, to do law at university. And she said, don't do it. And I was like, right. Oh no, because I'd never studied it at school. Cares don't offer it as an A-level. And she said, it's a bit of a risky move to study a subject you have no experience in. And she said, do English or history and then convert, because you're changing a 3-year degree into a 1-year. And I remember looking at her thinking, I know I can do this. Why am I going to waste 3 years doing a degree I'm not really bothered about just to get to the same end result?
And by the end of the conversation, she completely agreed with your point.
Yeah, exactly.
And she went, actually, you know what? This could be the career for you.
Yep. And that was the beginning of my future. So off I went to the University of Manchester, did my 3-year law degree there, and came back to Birmingham to do the 9 months intensive course called the BPTC. And that's where you get specifically trained to be a barrister. It's like barrister boot camp.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, lovely. It's not stressful at all.
But before you, so you mentioned you were down in Devon, but you had a few kind of hurdles to overcome, didn't you? You didn't get straight into it after university.
No, I mean, not for want of trying. I applied for pupillage during my BPTC year. And pupillage is so competitive. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of applicants and normally one or two spaces. And the process is normally is a lengthy application setting out all your academic qualifications and quite intense questions, why you want to be a barrister, why that particular chambers, and showing your skill set that would match the field. And then it's multiple rounds of interviews, often with quite a large interview panel built up of barristers and judges, and you get put through your paces in those. So I applied during my BPTC year and I was unsuccessful. And I was coming to the end of the BPTC year and I didn't have, for the first time in my life, I didn't have a next step. Before that, everything was mapped out for me. I knew what to do. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to America. Forget it. And I Googled some American law firms that looked pretty interesting. And I got the job and flew out the day after my last exam for the bar and lived in America for the best part of the next year.
Where about were you in America?
In Connecticut.
I don't really know. My US geography is terrible. So where
is Connecticut?
Connecticut
is a tiny little state. It's a tiny little state by Rhode Island, Massachusetts. It's in the New England collection of states. So it's about a 2-hour train ride from New York, where I was living. And the reason I went there is because that's the only state I knew people that lived there.
Right.
And I thought, if things go wrong, I just need a contact. And so it felt safe for me to be there. I've been there before. I sort of knew the state. It's very tiny. And I went. So I had two jobs out there. I did criminal defence work for a brilliant firm. And then I did personal injury work, which is now the work I do now, for a firm called Anderson, actually. Attorneys.
I've heard they're good.
Yeah, they're brilliant.
What are the differences like between the American and the British system?
Is it massive?
Because you'd think it'd be pretty much the same across the world, wouldn't you? In terms of, you know, if you're a doctor in the UK, then you're learning the same skills as a doctor in India or a doctor in Canada. But what's the differences in the legal system then?
I think the skill set is very much the same. You know, you've got to be able to talk to people, whether it's your client, a judge. You've got to be able to handle and manage a large workload. But the law is completely different. I mean, for example, I had a lot of drink driving cases. So in Connecticut, you get fitted with a little device in your car and you have to blow into it every certain amount of miles to check that you're still under the limit. Now, once you get to Massachusetts, you don't need that device, so you can unplug it from your car. And now Massachusetts is the equivalent of us driving from Birmingham to Manchester. So the laws change significantly between each state. And that's okay if you're on the West Coast when the states are huge. But when you're on the East Coast and the states are so close together, I mean, you can drive and the laws will change after you pass the state boundary. So that was a lot different to get my head around. And I don't think it's very fair, the justice system in America. My personal experience, for example, the idea of bail, you pay your own bail in America. So if you've got money, you can effectively buy your freedom temporarily. And if you don't have money, then you're remanded in custody. Whereas in England, you either get bail or you don't. You don't have to pay anything. It's whether the courts think you're a risk, a flight risk or not.
See, you always see that in the big American dramas, don't you? They've posted 2 million bail. I mean, my experience of law is very limited, Grace, as you've already seen from this conversation and as you will continue to see as we carry on. But I thought you had to pay bail here. But I suppose that's just come from the TV programmes.
That's 100% American. So in England, you apply for bail and you either get it or you don't. There are some cases where you can put up some security, which is almost a guarantee. But for the vast majority of the cases, no. Whereas in America, every single bail is given a price tag and you either can afford it or you can't, or you can afford part of it. And that's when you go for a bail bondsman. But then if you fly, you run away, that's when a bounty hunter comes after you. So it is very dramatic.
It sounds it. I suppose it's why you get so much good TV content from these real-life American crime shows. Lockdown's been tough for everyone. We've all got our vices. Mine is crappy American TV.
And they are brilliant, but my experience of a courtroom in America, I felt like I was in one of those documentaries. Mm. I mean, for example, you can hear a chain gang, in Connecticut, all the defendants are shackled together and they're in orange jumpsuits. They're ushered into court as a huge group. So it's about 6, 7, 8 men shackled together and you hear them coming down the corridor before they even get to the courtroom. It is quite striking coming as a Brit going to America. The disparity between the justice system was shocking, really.
Bringing it back to the UK then. So you applied for pupillage. You didn't get it. You went to the States. You applied for pupillage again when you got back, didn't you?
Yeah. Didn't get it.
Right.
I got quite far in a few sets of chambers, got to a final interview stage, but no, I didn't get pupillage. And then my visa had run up in America and I was thinking, right, now you're really coming up against it, because your bright idea of being innovative and creative and going to America to be a lawyer, now you can't do that anymore. So I came home. It was tough. It was quite a hard point because I didn't know what to do. And I thought, you know what? I don't have experience working for a solicitor's firm. Solicitors are crucial to a barrister's work. I mean, that's who instruct us. And I thought, you know what? It's going to make me stand out on my application if I get experience firsthand from a solicitor's point of view. So I applied to be a paralegal at Gateley PLC. At the time, it's changed names now, at Gateley PLC. And I worked there for a year. I was a paralegal there and I applied for pupillage during that year and I got pupillage, sat at my desk at Gateley and just screamed to the whole firm, I've done it. Yeah.
Thank you for talking to us about that, because I think I do remember looking around at school and actually when I went to university as well in Warwick, where people who have been lucky like us to go to a great school, have great teachers, it sets us up very well. And therefore, when you do encounter failure, it can be something that people aren't used to. You've always achieved. You've been told that actually you are in the top X percent of clever kids in Birmingham because you go to this school. We're going to get your A's in your GCSEs. You're going to get your A's in your... So then when failure does come along, it can hurt a lot more and it can knock people off track. Did you ever feel like, actually, you know what, I'm not going to do this. This isn't for me. What am I doing? Like you said earlier, I'm wasting my time here.
No, it is hard. Keres is a brilliant school and it's such a special school. And I don't think people can grasp how brilliant and how unique the school is without having experienced it. Now, I turned up at school. I'd come from a state primary school, you know, very normal school. I think there was two of us that went to Keres, me to the girls' school and Tim, who went to the boys' school. And I rocked up in year seven, thirds. I had a Brummy accent. I was one of the only girls in the class from a state school that had been in a class with real life boys. And I was academically nowhere near the top. The level of intelligence that I experienced at Keres from my peers was insane. So I don't think... Although we were told you're in the top percentile, that never really meant anything to me, because my direct competition were the girls that I was sat with 6, 7 hours a day. But it's definitely hard to get rejection. And there were times that I remember after the second year when I got rejected, I remember sitting down and thinking, have I got the strength to go through this whole process again. Because the problem with pupillage, you can only apply once a year. There's a window. So it's a whole 12 months of thinking of something to fill it before you can even go again. And I'm thinking, this is what you want to do. The road to success is never a smooth sailing journey. And if you really want this, you will go again. And I went again. I mean, it took a couple of days and I thought, no, pull at your bootstraps and just get down and get it done. And that's when I thought, you need to go to Gately. I need to get a different experience. What helped me, Ben, is that I'd already encountered quite a lot of rejection from performing arts. Right. Now, anyone that's ever been to an audition for internal at school with the drama society or professional will know that that is brutal. And I'd done 12 years of professional acting. So I'd gone through, they couldn't hurt me more than I'd already been hurt. So I thought, until I got rejected from pupillage. But it's all about just going again. And if you want it, you'll go for it. But it was hard. But I'm so grateful that I went again, because I wouldn't be where I am today.
It's really interesting what you say about performing arts, because I did theatre at university. I decided to pursue radio. Had a lot of friends who went into that world. And it is just rejection after rejection. I mean, Hannah Proops is talking about it a little bit in the episode that we did on Ed Talks with Hannah a few weeks back. People do look at the arts a little bit like, oh, that's nice. What, you're on stage? Oh, you're singing songs? You're doing this? You know, but actually, it can be absolutely brutal. And it's very difficult when you're doing something like that, I find, to kind of separate out. It's all very personal, or it can feel very personal. They don't want me. And it's not that actually your face doesn't fit for this, or you're not quite right for it for this reason. It's because I'm rubbish and you can't help it. So it's really interesting that actually what you do now, elements of performance. I think that's a really good message, is that if you like doing that, if that's the thing at school that you enjoy doing, there are so many different ways that you can incorporate that into completely different careers.
100%. I mean, every day my performing arts background helps me in my job, and people don't necessarily equate the two. I remember one of these workshops I had to go on in order to get my training, I was having a debate with a judge, and I was telling him that my performing background helps me every day with work, and it's the same job to a certain extent. Mm. And he said, no, it's not. Actors get scripts. They're told what to say. They just stand there. They're a puppet. And I looked at him and I said, articulation is important. Pronunciation, the ability to talk to different people. You know, I can go from talking to a judge to someone who's illiterate. You know, it's being able to communicate with a whole variety of people. And also, being on stage in live theatre, you have to adapt and react to unforeseen circumstances. Someone forgets a line, something goes wrong. You've got to do that with a poker face. And that's the same with court. The amount of times a client has said something and you think in your heart, oh, I really wish you didn't say that. But you can't react and you've just got to adapt, or there's something comes up in evidence that you weren't anticipating. You know, you've got to be able to think on your feet. And performing arts is brilliant, because I did theatre studies at A-level. I remember people saying to me, don't do it. It's a soft subject. It's not going to help you be a lawyer. And they were so wrong. And I'm so glad I did it.
In terms of then, you know, you're in the courtroom. I mean, I want to talk to you about kind of COVID in the courts in a minute, because that seems to be something that's bubbling away. I don't know if it's just on social media. It's very easy to get lost on Twitter, isn't it? And kind of trail of negativity. But in normal life, let's take it away from COVID. What do you do on a day-to-day basis? Are you more often in court, or are you more often preparing a case? Like, how does it, you know, what's a standard week? Or is there a standard week?
Okay. So if we take it back to March, when we went into lockdown, my first day with my own case in court on my own for the first ever time was April the 1st. April Fool's Day nonetheless, but April the 1st. We went into lockdown 8 days before my first proper day. So I lost my whole diary because of COVID for the first 2 months. When my diary started picking back up, I was doing crime at the time. I was doing crime, family and civil law. Because there was such a huge backlog of cases, I was in court all day, every day, 5 days a week. And that happened pretty much up until I left Devon. Now, when I move back to Birmingham, the set I'm at now, I only do civil work. So I do personal injury and clinical negligence. So the way my week is, it's very different now. Majority of my hearings are over telephone or Skype. I still have, you know, a few hearings a day, probably 1 to 3 hearings a day. And then I'm in court physically about once a week, once a fortnight. It's very minimal. But that's because I'm not doing crime anymore. If I continue to be in crime, I would still be in court every day.
So coronavirus has affected, you know, every industry, every person in the world. We're talking early February 2021. We're still in lockdown. I remember when we first went into lockdown back last March, and there was a lot of negativity around the construction industry, because construction carried on working when everyone else was in lockdown. And there was a hashtag shut the sites, and, you know, quite a lot of venom, actually. Like, I work with a few different podcasts that are in the construction industry, and the experiences of people being yelled at on the way to work in the morning and to the building sites, etc. Why are you doing this? You should be at home. You're greedy, this, that and the other. There's been a bit of that around courts this time. There's a few people, I don't know if they're a loud minority, but there's a few people who think that the courts shouldn't be open whilst the UK is in lockdown. What do you think about that?
I think the courts have to be open. Just because we're in a lockdown does not prohibit people or prevent people from committing crime. You know, if we take the criminal courts, the magistrates and the crown courts, for example, you have to, every single criminal case that reaches a court goes to a magistrate's court first. No matter the seriousness of the case, it's just a funneling process. And then it's deemed either to go to the crown court or it stays in the magistrates. Now, without these courts being open, people aren't going through the justice process. They're not being sentenced, punished, assisted. Victims of crime aren't getting the justice that they require. And lockdown hasn't slowed that crime down. So therefore, lockdown shouldn't slow the courts down. Now, inevitably, it has slowed the courts down because there can't be more than X amount of people in a court at one time because of social distancing. So naturally, court proceedings take a lot longer than they did pre-COVID. But you only need to look at cases such as domestic violence. The statistic for domestic violence cases absolutely rocketed post-lockdown. I don't think it's hard for the imagination to wonder why it did, with couples being locked down, especially if they are in a domestic abusive relationship. Therefore, to prohibit or to impede access to justice for that victim or that complainant, to me, is complete antithesis of what the court is designed to do. Ultimately, we can't just allow offenders, criminals on the streets to go wandering and free just because of COVID. The courts have been taking any hearings they can make them remote. They have been doing them remote.
Right.
Trials stopped for a long time because they couldn't physically get a jury into a courtroom whilst being socially distanced. So for those people accused of a crime that were on bail, you know, these people were in society and they were potentially very dangerous people. So there's a need, there's a public interest in getting these cases pushed through. And I think it's in the interest of the whole society for courts to continue to operate. And we'd be in a very dangerous position if the courts had shut in March and were still shut now, because justice would effectively be paused.
Did you say that up to 2 million cases in a backlog at the moment?
I was in a robing room the other day getting ready for court and we were talking, and that was the latest statistic I heard, that because of COVID taking from March, there was a 2 million case backload.
How long does it take to clear that many cases? How long would it take the courts to catch up?
The thing is, we have no idea, because the courts have never endured this before. They've never experienced such a global situation that has affected every single country in different ways. So the simple answer is we just don't know. Now, I don't know whether those 2 million cases are formed with criminal, civil, family. I mean, there's been arguments that civil cases should be paused because there's less of a public interest demand. But then if you look at civil cases such as injunctions or protection orders, you know, they're still so important. Similarly to children that are in foster care, you know, should they just be left to sit in foster care because the courts haven't got time to deal with their case? We just don't know. But the courts are working tirelessly. You know, since January, Saturday courts are now open. So cases run on a Saturday and court runs pretty normal. So it's basically a 6-day week. And I've been doing Saturday courts in this month. the courts are keen just to push through as many cases as possible. And the problem with the crime is that because every case has to get before a magistrate's first, it's almost like a bottleneck of cases until it's funneled and filtered and sorted out.
But do you think that process will change? Do you think they might have to go, look, there's just too much of a backlog here and we need to shorten this process down? Or can it not be sped up? Do you have to, you know, is every stage of the process paramount to the process being completed properly?
It's definitely an argument. I mean, this is a topic for debate that's been going for the last few years, even pre-COVID, about whether the funnel, the filter system is necessary to justice being achieved. There are arguments for and against that. I mean, one would argue that it's crucial for it to be before a magistrate so it can be identified what the issues are, so it can be correctly allocated. Or some people think, well, some crimes are so obviously too complex or serious to be dealt with by a magistrate, they should go straight to the Crown Court. It's really difficult, and I think COVID hasn't helped that pre-standing issue.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
How are you finding doing what you do remotely? Like, we've all seen Prime Minister's questions where, you know, an MP will come up on the screen, the Right Honourable, you're on mute, or, you know, not the technology side, but it can't be the same experience.
It's so difficult. So I was doing a lot of sentences remotely. So you'd have a defendant in a courtroom, you'd have the judge in a courtroom, and I was the prosecutor. And I'd be saying, well, so-and-so should spend X amount of years in prison, but I've never met this person. I'm not even in the same room with him. I'm in this room. And it does feel a bit artificial, but it's all we're left with at the moment. And we've just got to do our best. But it's a weird situation. I think the best way to define working from home is that I'll be in a suit from the waist up and then tracksuit bottoms from the waist down.
No, I'm definitely not doing that right now.
Do you know what I mean? It feels odd. Or there'll be people, so I'm talking to a judge and he'll be in his wig and gown, and I know that I've got my pyjama bottoms on. It's a bit bizarre, really.
How does
but
it
we're
work?
Doing our best.
Is the jury remote? Like, are there cases where the jury is remote? Or do they have to be there?
So for a trial, every single person that's a party to the case will be physically in a courtroom. Hmm. So it's only really sentences and other hearings that take place remotely.
Yeah.
So if you imagine you've got in a courtroom, you can see where the jury would sit and you've got the public gallery. Now, quite often, I can only speak for the courts that I practiced in Devon, but the criminal courts in Devon, they didn't allow any public in the courtroom at all. And the jurors were spaced out over where the jury sit and the public gallery,
right,
into enable social distancing. And then they'd often use another courtroom for the public gallery and live stream. Right. And they'd watch it on a television effectively. Now I'm doing civil. A lot of my trials have been remotely. So either via Teams, Skype or on the telephone. And you'll have, you know, the claimant, the defendant, claimant's barrister, defendant's barrister and the judge all in little screens on a laptop. Mm. And that does feel odd. Because I remember when I joined Number 5, I said to them, although I've been practicing civil work for the last 6 months, I have never done a civil case physically in a courtroom because they'd all been on the telephone.
Yeah.
And I think it's those, because my whole development as a barrister has taken place in COVID. So it is a very obscure way to train and to learn the craft. So, but it is odd, but everyone's just adapting and the courts are getting much better and barristers are so used to doing things remotely now that it has almost become second nature. And when you're required to be in court, especially as a civil practitioner, you're like, really? I'm actually meant to go to court? It's an odd one now.
I'm interested in, I mean, I don't know, I haven't asked you to prepare any crime statistics, but obviously you talked about domestic violence increasing. Mm. And actually, I remember that being quite hot on the agenda last year, because when we were in lockdown, that was then suddenly put onto, this is a reasonable excuse. This is a reasonable, if you need to leave, if you need to travel, then that was added. I don't think it was there initially in terms of...
No.
But, I mean, you think that when the world's in lockdown, what other crime is happening? Is it an increase in cybercrime?
I think definitely the domestic abuse is the one that's been at the forefront of everything. I wouldn't like to speak on specific crimes that have increased. Mm. The cases that I've personally done have not differed pre-COVID or post-COVID. So when I was doing crime and I was prosecuting, you know, you'd find the same theft from shops, you know, the burglary, nothing. I mean, yeah, you're not going to get a punch in a nightclub because the nightclubs aren't open, but you'll get a punch in the street right outside the nightclub. You know, the crime doesn't change. So actually, lockdown doesn't affect anything. If those want to commit crime or need to commit crimes, you know, to fund a habit, or, you know, they're stealing from shops because they can't afford to buy, that's still going to maintain. What's been interesting is the amount of offences that have arisen because of COVID, right, which is something that a lot of people didn't anticipate. So, for example, coughing in someone's face and saying, I've got COVID, threatening to spit on someone and saying, I've got COVID. And I found that I've done quite a lot of cases where someone's being arrested for a completely different crime and will spit on a police officer, say, I've got COVID, and then they'll get charged with an assault on an emergency worker.
So that's classed as so coughing in someone's face would be classed as assault.
Well, so the one, I've done a lot of spitting or, you know, hitting a police officer that's been classed as an assault. But since COVID, I've now done a lot of threats to cough on someone because they say they've got COVID.
And I suppose it doesn't, you know, if they have or not, that doesn't, it's the threat that's the...
Exactly. And that's the offence. It's how it makes the person feel, whether they feel in danger of their immediate safety. And if you're saying, I've got COVID, I'm going to spit in your face, then a lot of offences are being brought to court because of that.
How interesting.
It really is interesting. Yeah. We've had to adapt quickly. And that's the long and short of it. It's a bit like prisoners that are going to do, or defendants that are going to do custodial sentences. There's a case called Manning that has been before the court every single day, because it says effectively that prison sentences are a lot harder now because of COVID, because prisoners are on a 23, 24 hour lockup a day.
Right. Okay.
So whereas before they'd be out of their cell a lot more doing education or working, now they're in a lockdown because of COVID. So effectively, like, their sentences should be reflected in their sentences to counter the fact that doing time in prison now is a lot harder than it would have been, you know, pre-COVID.
So what are they asking for? Reduced sentences?
A reduction in sentence, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a reduction in sentence to counter the fact that people in prison are now not seeing family, whereas they could see them before. You know, they're not working, not going to education. They're effectively sat in a cell 23, 24 hours a day. And so there's a plea before the court to reduce their sentence to reflect that.
Grace, I'd like to say thank you so much for your time today, because it's so interesting. There's just things that you just don't, as a normal member of society, you're just going about my daily business in lockdown, of course. There's things you just don't think about until you delve into the conversation. It's been really interesting talking to you. Before we go, I ask everyone this, and it's not a qualification or a certificate or anything like that. In terms of what you've achieved, what would you say is the characteristic that has helped you get to where you are today?
Perseverance. 100% perseverance. It's not enough to dream for something. You have to work for it. And my whole personal ethos is that I haven't come this far to just come this far. And if it wasn't for my own personal story, if I didn't persevere through all of the rejection and setbacks, no matter how, you know, much they hurt, or some rejection cut deep, if I didn't persevere, then I couldn't sit before you today and talk about the fact that on a daily basis, I get to live out the job of my dreams. And if I could tell, you know, 16-year-old me that one day you will be a barrister, I just think it would take a whole lot of stress and worry off a 16-year-old's shoulders. So perseverance would be my answer.
So you haven't come this far to only get this far. What's the ambition?
My short-term ambition is to get tenancy at number 5 Chambers.
Because they're brilliant and they're fantastic and they're great people to work with. Yeah.
Let's say it again. Yeah. Because I'm proud to be at that set. You know, when I first interviewed at that set, when I was, for the first time I got rejected, I kept their notepad that they gave me when I walked into Chambers and it had their name on, and I kept it with me, and I thought one day you will be a member of this set. So that's my short-term ambition and I'm living for that at the moment. And then once I get tenancy, I don't know, the world's my oyster. Develop a very busy and successful practice and then maybe one day consider taking the bench and becoming a judge would be the dream.
I think Judge Gwynne's got a good ring to it.
Thank you. Thanks, Ben. So do I.
Grace, thanks ever so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.